Death, 24 times a second, by Laura Mulvey. This is chapter 2, Uncertainty, Natural Magic, and the Art of Deception. The cinema is descended from two contradictory ancestral lines that combine to make it the first ever medium to fulfill the long-standing aspiration to show moving images of the real world. Its relation to reality is, of course, shared with photography, and comes from the tradition of the camera obscura. While its movement belongs to the tradition of optical illusions that exploit a peculiar ability of the human eye to deceive the mind. Contained in this ancestry is a scientific drive to understand the eye, optics, or light. But the scientific drive fed into new kinds of popular entertainment, as the economic and social conditions for a popular culture emerged during the 19th century. Magicians and illusionists developed the arts of deception, end quotes, appealing to human fascination with the unnatural, the impossible, and ultimately the supernatural. The ideological mode of address adopted by these entrepreneurs would change over time. The dangerous, forbidden activities involved with summoning up the devil and his tricks gave way to other kinds of beliefs that, over and over again, tapped into the wide and changing variety of superstitions and beliefs associated with life after death. The cinema concentrated into itself a range of these pre-existing forms of illusion and entertainment. Illusions of the supernatural typically bring into play peculiarities of both human vision and the human mind. A mind bewildered by optical and other kinds of illusions, doubting the reality of what it sees with its own eyes, is more prepared to be credulous when exposed to the emanations of the supernatural. An otherwise confident and competent relation to the world is suddenly faced by a sense of uncertainty. Whatever ideology or commercial enterprise might fuel these phenomena, they share an aesthetic of deception, an appeal to the mind's pleasure in illusion and its constant readiness to be fooled. The machines of deception necessarily had a complex relation to the different ideologies within which they functioned, veering between complicity with irrational belief and its debunking. As they unveiled the workings of their illusions, the magicians demystified, in quotes, the ways in which human credulity could always be exploited. In the aftermath of the Enlightenment, the world of the sacred was in retreat, so that pleasure in the irrational could emerge from religion into culture, as, for instance, in the early 19th century cult of the Gothic. Even as the last shreds of superstition and religion seemed to retreat into the past, some irreducible core of human irrationality persisted. Freud's great contribution to modernity was to recognize that the irrational was intrinsic to human reason, housed, in quotes, in the unconscious. While, in the first instance, the problem of sexuality structures the Freudian unconscious, it is also colonized by irrational fears, and that most rational of fears, the inevitability of death that lies beyond the pleasure principle. That was in quotes. Although there was no mutual interest, there is a coincidence of chronology in the 1980s between Freud's ambition to find ways of analyzing the irrational and the arrival of the cinema. Cinema gathered together and streamlined its prehistory of illusion and deception by means of natural magic, giving modernity a perfect site on which to play out the continuing dramas of reality, the unconscious, and the imagination. The convergence between the arts of reality and the arts of deception that brought about the birth of the cinema in 1895 prefigures the convergence between the cinema machine and digital technology from 1997 that seemed to signal its death. George Millais stands at the first 19th century crossroads. A professional magician at the end of a long line of illusionists, Millais brought cinema to magic, merging the two traditions and embodying the family relation between them. Millay had two moments of epiphany in his life. The first took place at Maskelyne's Permanent Magic Theater, the Egyptian Hall, in London in 1888, where he fell in love with magic, and on his return to Paris took over the theater of the famous prestidigitator Jean-Eugène Robert Houdini, after whom Houdini later named himself. The second was the Lumiere brothers. The second was the Lumiere brothers' demonstration of the cinematograph in 1895 at the Grand Café in Paris, when he is said to have exclaimed, "What a great trick! That's for me!" He then created a film studio that fused the new cinematic potential for trickery with the traditions of the magic theater. In 1951, the Surrealists published a list dividing the history of the cinema into two opposed columns of names. The Lumières headed one list, "Don't See." Millay's headed the other, "See." For the Surrealists, the Lumiere brothers' cinema was tied to the banal realm of realism, while Millay could conjure up a parallel universe of surreal magic and marvelous effects. Looking back, after more than a century since the advent of cinema, this opposition no longer seems so simple. Both cinemas now have associations with the marvelous. It is impossible to see the Lumiere films as a simple demonstration of a new technology. Every gesture, expression, movement of wind or water is touched with mystery. It is not the mystery of the magic trick, but the more disturbing, uncanny sensation of seeing movement fossilized for the first time. This uncanny effect was also very vividly present for the cinema's first spectators. The image's silence and lack of color added to their ghostly atmosphere. Maxim Gorky's well-known response to the Lumiere films bears witness to this, as he wrote in 1896 for a Russian newspaper, quote, "It is terrifying to watch, but it is the movement of shadows, mere shadows, curses and ghosts, evil spirits that have cast whole cities into eternal sleep come to mind, and you feel as though Merlin's vicious trick has been played out before you," end quote. As cinema technology became integrated into everyday life and its workings were no longer mysterious, the Lumiere's films were overtaken by the banality of their reality, like any home movie or technological demonstration, to be dismissed by the Surrealists. But now, after more than 100 years, the further passing of time has created a third face, and that very reality has become the source of uncanniness. The phantom-like quality observed by Gorky and his contemporaries returns in force. The inanimate images of the film strip not only come alive in projection, but are the ghostly images of the now-dead resurrected into the appearance of life. These three phases illustrate, in the first instance, that a technological uncanny waxes and wanes, but also that the cinema as an institution varies in relation to its surrounding ideologies and modes of address. As it evolved into its second phase of everyday entertainment and modernity, fiction turned the cinema towards other psychic structures, for instance, the mechanisms of suspended disbelief that Christian Metz identified with fetishism, or the discourses of sexuality and visual pleasure analyzed by feminist film theory. This was the cinema that, like the 20th century itself, left behind the morbid spirit of the Victorians to become an emblem of modernity, both as popular entertainment and as modernist avant-garde. Of course, both these aspects of film culture could and did, in their different ways, recycle the traditions of the uncanny. But for most of the century, the cinema's stand was on the side of the new. There is an irony in the way the phantoms conjured up by early cinema have caught up with the ever-increasing crowd of ghosts that now haunt it. In his essay of 1919, The Uncanny, Freud distinguishes between two effects associated with the problem of death. First of all, there is a dread that the already dead might return to haunt the present from the past. Then there is the difficulty for the living subject, while accepting the inevitable, to imagine its own death at some unknown point in the future. While Freud felt that the first belief in ghosts could be dismissed as a residue of superstition in the post-Enlightenment world, he thought that the second posed a problem for even the most enlightened minds. In certain circumstances, one fear could summon up the other, perpetuating the power of the irrational over the rational. Religious insistence on the existence of an afterlife could feed into belief in the return of the dead. The threshold between life and death becomes a space of uncertainty in which boundaries blur between the rational and the supernatural, the animate and the inanimate. But there is a further opposition between the old and the new that runs through Freud's essay of 1919. For Freud, an uncanny effect can only be produced by the old, and he discounts the possibility that the new might make the human mind and its body shudder involuntarily. Freud is, in the first instance, taking issue with Wilhelm Jungsch's essay of 1906 on the psychology of the uncanny. He dismisses Jungsch's interest in an uncanny effect that is aroused by the new and the unfamiliar, by automata, you pick, or waxworks, for instance. Oh, automata. You know, like automatons. That's what I think they're talking about. Anyhow, and after quite a long detour, he reflects rather on the uncanny nature of death itself, the living body's passage into an inanimate state. However, Freud's uncanny and Jungsch's uncanny come more closely together whenever the animate and the inanimate become confused. A mechanical replica of the human body and the human body from which life is departed both threaten the crucial division between animate and inanimate, organic and inorganic bodies. In one case, the organic body has become inanimate. In the other, the inorganic body takes on the appearance of animation. Both are persistent objects of human fear and fascination. In 19th century Paris, for instance, people flocked to see the corpses that were displayed at the Paris morgue as public spectacle. At the same time, they also flocked to see the lifelike waxworks exhibited at the Musée Grévin. However, both Jungsch and Freud note a third phenomenon. Beyond the physical presence of the inanimate body are those narratives in which the dead return to the world of the living as a ghostly apparition, inorganic but animate. Jungsch, it seems, was interested in the kind of trompe l'oeil phenomena that had proliferated with the rise of 19th century optical entertainment and mechanical toys. Quote, "The unpleasant impression is well known that readily arises in many people when they visit collections of wax figures, panopticons, and panoramas. In the semi-darkness, it is often especially difficult to distinguish a life-size wax or similar figure from a human person, whether it is animate or not." He goes on to say, "This peculiar effect makes its appearance even more clearly when imitations of the human form not only reach one's perception, but when on top of everything else they appear to be united with certain bodily or mental functions. For example, life-size automata that perform complicated tasks, blow trumpets, dance, and so forth, very easily give one a feeling of unease. The finer the mechanism, and the truer to nature the formal reproduction, the more strongly will the special effects also make its appearance." End quote. And he associates the uncanny effect, end quotes, with doubts. Intellectual uncertainty about whether an apparently animate being is really alive, or conversely, whether a lifeless object might not in fact be animate. Jungsch's subsequent citation of the E.T.A. Hoffman stories of automata provokes Freud's rather convoluted digression in the uncanny. He argues in particular that Olympia, the beautiful mechanical doll in The Sandman, is irrelevant to the uncanny aspects of the story, and that the source of the hero's breakdown lies in castration anxiety. The Sandman is discussed further at the end of this chapter. It is here that Freud asserts his crucial theoretical principle, quote, only that class of frightening that leads back to the old and familiar can be of interest to psychoanalysis. To put it in another way, for an emotional effect to have a relation to the unconscious mind, it must have undergone a process of repression from which it may return. The modern and the newfangled could only represent a return of the repressed if they triggered something which is familiar and old established in the mind, a formative structure of the unconscious itself, such as the castration complex. It seems that even in 1906, Jentsch was unaware of the cinema's relevance to his proposition, but his comments on replicas of the human body, automata, and so on clearly confirmed Freud's theoretical resistance to the new and to the modern world and its manifestations more generally. In keeping with this theoretical position, Freud discusses one aspect of the uncanny that is truly archaic, not in the history of the individual psyche, but in the history of human culture. His comments on, quote, the uncanny experience when primitive beliefs which have been surmounted seem once more to be confirmed, end quote. He identifies the persistence of superstition most closely with the feeling experienced by many people, quote, in relation to death and death bodies, to the return of the dead and to spirits and ghosts. And he points to the near universal insistence, both by religions and by civil governments, on the existence of life after death. Quote, there is scarcely any other matter, however, upon which our thoughts and feelings have changed so little since the earliest times, in which discarded forms have been so completely preserved under a thin disguise as our relation to death. End quote. Having dismissed Jentsch's association between the uncanny and intellectual uncertainty in relation to, quote, whether an inanimate object becomes too like an animate one, Freud backtracks slightly, quote, and are we, after all, justified in entirely ignoring intellectual uncertainty as a factor in the uncanny, seeing that we have admitted its importance in relation to death? That's the end of that quote. There are two slightly different points here. First of all, Freud is referring somewhat ironically to the persistent belief on the part of civilized, in quotes, people and their religions in the afterlife and ultimately the resurrection of the body. Secondly, against the precepts of established religions, residues of archaic fears and superstition survive. First, the belief that the spirits of the dead are able to visit the living, and then that the natural world is itself inhabited and animated by the presence of spirits. When he accepts that intellectual uncertainty may be a factor, in quotes, particularly due to its relation to death, Freud quite incidentally suggests a way in which his identification of the uncanny with the old, that's in quotes, may combine with Jentsch's new mechanical uncanny. Certainly it is a bridging concept linking the two. The popular cultures of the uncanny had, for quite some time, created illusions out of uncertainties particular to the human mind, juxtaposing an uncanny of optical devices and illusions with appearances of ghosts and the spirits of the dead. In his book, The Great Art of Light and Shadow, Laurent Manoni vividly traces the recurring association between the magic lantern and its gothic offspring, the phantasmagoria, and the culture of the uncanny. Raising spirits was the central tour de force of the famous illusions created by Philidor in the Paris of the Enlightenment, and later by Etienne Gaspard Robertson after the Revolution. Both claimed that their performances aimed to, quote, destroy absurd beliefs, the childish terrors, which dishonor the intelligence of man, end quote. But in its actuality, The spectacle itself, quote, sought more to create fear than to dispel the occult source of fear, end quote. A contemporary commentator described the effect in the following terms. This is a quote. Reason has told you well that these are mere phantoms, catoptric tricks devised with artistry, carried out with skill, and presented with intelligence. Your weakened brain can only believe what it is made to see, and we believe ourselves transported into another world and other centuries. End quote. Tom Gunning, in his introduction to Manoni's book, draws attention to Freud's concept of the uncanny as the lingering of an irrational belief, often unconscious, after the conscious has dismissed the old belief as nonsense. He then sums up with great precision the complex mental processes involved. Quote, as the magic lantern had embodied the marvels of the new science in the 17th century, so at the close of the 18th it acted out the contest between superstition and reason with a form of illusion which could invoke both simultaneously. The attraction of the phantasmagoria, which soon became a worldwide form of entertainment, literally enacted the new consciousness of modernity. Torn between doubt and credulity, fascinated by the way its senses could be entertained as its logic sought, not always successfully, for explanations. End quote. This explicit recognition of the space between credulity and knowledge recalls the mid-17th century Jesuit Athanasius Kircher's insistence that the illusions created by his camera obscura were of nature, not magic. While pointing out that Kircher did not, as is often supposed, invent the magic lantern, Manoni suggests that he inaugurated a tradition of showmanship that would survive into the magic acts of the 19th century. Quote, what Kircher aspired to more than anything was to astonish his followers by the almost universal nature of his knowledge. However, he did not want to pass himself off as a sorcerer and denounce the quacks who used optics to take advantage of the credulous. Kircher's aim in revealing all these illuminated and shadowy optical tricks was to enlighten the general public, end quote. The concept of uncertainty becomes a nodal point at which disparate ideas meet and branch off in new directions. The masters of phantasmagoria harness new technologies to old superstitions, but in the process laid the foundations for something new. The showman's juggling of contradictions represents a turning point at which they no longer expected their patrons to believe that to believe what they saw, but to be amazed at the illusions conjured up, distinguishing between the ability to deceive the human eye and to trick the mind. This is an uncertainty of secular materialism that takes pleasure in the culture of illusions and the uncanny, and prefigures later forms of mass entertainment. Pleasure in the material relation between illusion and optics, and between illusion and momentary credulity, playing with the mind's susceptibility to trickery, all involve various successive phases of exchange between the eye and the mind, belief, doubt, curiosity, that leads towards the uncertainty of Gunning's new consciousness of modernity. End quotes. The uncertainty of phantasmagoria also suggests various ways in which Freud's and Jentsch's differing approaches to the inanimate body might be brought into dialogue. First of all, Jentsch's uncanny of, quote, the new and unfamiliar, end quote, leads to the disorientation caused by a technological uncanny, end quote. The most rational mind experiences uncertainty when faced with an illusion that is, if only momentarily, inexplicable. As Jentsch puts it, quote, even when they know they are being fooled by merely harmless illusions, many people cannot suppress an extremely uncomfortable feeling. End quote. This kind of frisson can be located in the moment itself, the sudden moment of doubt, an involuntary and bewildered loss of certainty. A central strand running through the whole history of visual illusions is contained in this effect, and its investment in that moment. It is instantaneous and produced by a particular encounter. Jentsch's argument then meets Freud's uncanny, the persistence in the human mind of belief in the supernatural and the return of the dead. He comments, to repeat the quotation above, "Primitive fear of the dead is still so strong within us and always ready to come to the surface on any provocation." That's the end of that quote. To bring the two sides together, archaic beliefs and superstitions are able to return within the popular culture of illusions that are not only disorienting, but also exploit this particular repressed fear of the dead. As new technologies are often outside popular understanding when they first appear, the most advanced scientific developments can, paradoxically, enable and revive irrational and superstitious beliefs in an animate world. The magic shows the technological uncanny, and the magician's illusion merged with the resurrection of the body and the materialization of the spirit world. It is here that Jentsch's interest in the new and the mechanical overlaps with the residues of belief in the supernatural. During the 19th century, the explosion of new technologies and the popular belief that grew up around them overwhelmed the earlier tradition of demystifying the mechanics of illusion and debunking credulity. According to Tom Gunning, the invention of photography created a new field for inquiry about perception and its relation to knowledge and belief. In particular, the spiritualist movement related their revelations to new technologies such as electricity, telegraphy, chemistry, and so on. As they first appeared, these technologies seemed paradoxically to give credence to the idea that invisible forces animated the world. The impact that these developments had on the contemporary imagination was not only due to the technological novelties that they produced, but also to the fact that they made visible forces that existed, hitherto invisible, within the natural world. A technological novelty gives rise to a technological uncanny in a collision between science and the supernatural. Thus, the intrinsic ghostliness of the black and white photograph alighted with the sense that the machine might be able to perceive a presence invisible to the human eye. Similarly, the phenomenon of electricity had illustrated the way that the invisible in the natural world could, once harnessed, have powerful visible effects. In their summoning up of ghosts, the spiritualists exploited, on the one hand, this new animism, end quotes, the sense of a world filled with spirits at long last made visible. On the other, they touched on the long-standing reluctance of the human mind to confront death. Freud comments ironically in his essay, The Uncanny, quote, "It is true that the statement, all men are mortal, is paraded in textbooks of logic as an example of a general proposition, but no human being really grasps it, and our unconscious has as little use now as it ever had for the idea of its own mortality," end quote. And he goes on to mention, also ironically, the renewed fashion for spiritualism, quote, "In our great cities, placards announce lectures that undertake to tell us how to get in touch with the souls of the departed, and it cannot be denied that not a few of our most able and penetrating minds among our men of science have come to the conclusion, especially towards the end of their own lives, that a contact of this kind is not impossible," end quote. The Uncanny was written in 1919, when many of the bereaved attempted to reach the other side, in quotes, after the appalling loss of life during World War I. But cultures of and around death were deeply ingrained in the late 19th century. Once the phenomenon of spiritualism began to move into the realm of show business and the spectacular, in Gunning's words, it mined a deep fascination in visual events that amazed spectators by defying conventional belief, end quote. Spiritualism in the culture of death on the one hand, and rational secularism on the other, provided yet another twist to the space of intellectual and technological uncertainty. The encounter between spectacular spiritualism and the 19th century magic show led the showmen to distance themselves from those charlatans who insisted that their tricks truly raise the dead. John Neville Maskelyne, for instance, developed his magic show without, as he put it, the help of spirits. He was a showman who prided himself on his own skill and ability to make an audience gasp, on the cusp between credulity and incredulity. "I don't believe it!" That's what they were gasping. While seeing with their own eyes, Harry Houdini became deeply involved in the campaign to debunk spiritualism, leading to his fraught friendship with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who was convinced that he had reached his son killed in World War I through a medium. Adam Phillips has described Houdini's implacable hostility to spiritualism as going beyond professionalism to conviction. This is a quote. "Like any successful professional magician, and Houdini was the man who put magic on the map, who took it out of quackery and into mainstream entertainment. Houdini had no appetite for the inexplicable. He wasn't keen to be impressed by it. He didn't claim to understand everything, but what had always fascinated him was people's talent for creating mystery. Why, Sir Arthur," he once remarked to Doyle, "I have been trained in mystery all my life, and once in a while I see something I can't account for. But when this happened, he wanted to discover how someone had made it. Mystery, for Houdini, was the great secular commodity." End quote. The showmen purged their magic tricks of any connection with the supernatural in order to open up the space for a different kind of amazement. If the audience believed that a divine power had intervened, their emotions would be, indeed, awestruck, but the act would belong to the realm of the supernatural, and thus be perfectly explicable. The showman's aim was to create a space for doubt and generate the frisson associated with the breakdown of understanding that gives rise not to a belief in the illusion, but to a sense of intellectual uncertainty. This is their modernity. They shifted the cultural agenda towards a kind of superhumanity in which their own transcendent powers were at center stage. While the rigorous materiality of the performance would cause astonishment, their feats would inevitably raise questions about the limits of the human, how the magicians were able to defy the laws of nature in such a way that an ordinary audience would be unable to decipher what they were seeing. The invention of photography and its diffusion in the mid-19th century introduced an element of the uncanny that was part of its material process and persisted in its own right after the ghost photographers had disappeared. The uncanny of the phantasmagoria and other ghostly spectacles, in which technology and lingering superstition had been so closely entwined, was recast in rather different terms. The photograph actually preserved mechanically a moment of life stopped and then held in perpetuity. It was the extraordinary skill of the showmen, both in their technological and artistic preparation and the actual stage management of the show itself, that had been the source of their success. While these were beautifully and convincingly conjured illusions, the photograph was the descendant of the natural magic shows of Kircher's and Della Porta's Camera Obscura. It reproduced a record of the real world through the inscription of light, but it was also able to capture and fix that moment of reality on photosensitive material. With photography, the question of time and its passing, its relation to the past, to the old, and to death, came into play. Ian Christie has pointed out that uncertainty associated with death was a crucial factor in the late 19th century citizens' response to film. Quote, "What did they want to believe? Essentially, that death was not final. that communication with the other side, end quotes, was possible. So the respectable Victorians threw themselves into spiritualism, seances, tarot cards, and magic of any kind. In the climate, it was scarcely surprising that moving pictures seemed supernatural to their first viewers. Both the Paris papers which reported the first Lumiere show ended on the same note. Death will cease to be absolute. It will be possible to see our nearest alive again long after they have gone. End quote. If the contemporary response to the Lumiere films aligns them on side of Freud's ghostly uncanny, Millais transfers to cinema many characteristic attributes of Jentsch's uncanny, exploiting technological novelty as well as the cinema's ability to blur the boundary between the animate and the inanimate with trick photography. As Paul Hammond describes, quote, "An object can be transformed either instantaneously or gradually into another object. An object can grow or diminish before our eyes, while the rest of the image remains a constant size. An object, usually human, can disintegrate into parts, then these can assume a life of their own. An inanimate object can begin to move, and an animate one defy the laws of gravity. An object appear or disappear instantaneously or gradually." End of quote. And he comments particularly on the phenomenon noted by Jentsch, whereby inanimate images of the body take on apparently animate properties. Quote, "Not only statues, but scarecrows, snowmen, dummies, skeletons, figures in paintings, posters, photographs, playing card, and book illustrations all pulsate with life through the camera's stop-motion capability." End quote. Just as the cinema animated the inanimate photograph, so Millais used the cinema machine to give life to lifeless representations of the human figure. This aspect of his cinema belongs to a tradition in which replicas of the body acquired the appearance of life. For instance, in the marionette theater, clockwork toys, or the fantastic stories of automata. Through Jentsch's reference to Olympia, the beautiful automaton in E.T.A. Hoffman's story The Sandman, the question of gender in relation to the uncanny of automata comes to the fore. This is a crucial moment at which Freud takes issue with Jentsch. He argues that the beautiful mechanical doll is irrelevant to the uncanny aspects of the story, and that the source of its hero's breakdown lies in castration anxiety. Olympia introduces the question of gender, if only negatively, into Freud's understanding of the uncanny, into the significance of his opposition between old and new, and his dismissive attitude towards modernity. In Hoffman's story, there is indeed ample evidence that its hero, Nathaniel, has had traumatic childhood experiences that could have led to intense castration anxiety. Freud sees his symptoms very much in terms of displaced anxiety about his eyes provoked by the two vengeful father figures, the vendor of eyeglasses, Coppola, otherwise known as Coppelius, and Spallanzini, the father of the automaton Olympia, father in quotes. When Coppola sells him a telescope, Nathaniel looks across the street and sees the beautiful and mysterious young woman in close-up through its lens. It is this moment that initiates his obsession with Olympia. His previously normal erotic interest in the scientist's beautiful daughter, in quotes, is transformed into a fetishistic fascination that has materialized out of a mechanism of enhanced vision, the telescope. The artificial cut, in quotes, into another space reinforces the displacement that transforms Nathaniel's castration anxiety into disavowal. Olympia is the perfect fetish object. Her wooden inanimate body is not wounded, in quotes, and she acts as a screen for Nathaniel, reflecting directly back to him his unconscious fantasies, enabling the repression of his fears. Freud's own disavowal of the doll's mediating place in Nathaniel's crisis is so acute that he misreads the tragic ending of the story. Once Nathaniel recovers from the nervous breakdown that has been precipitated by the sight of the two evil father figures fighting over and dismantling Olympia, he is reunited with his living, loving fiancée, Clara. One day, when they climb to the top of a tower to admire the view, a strange figure in the street below distracts them. Taking out his telescope to look more closely, Nathaniel focuses the lens not, as Freud claims, on Coppola below, but on Clara at his side, whom he mistakes for the wooden doll. His symptoms return, and having tried to throw Olympia from the tower, he falls himself to his death. Olympia, as beautiful automaton, also fascinates and horrifies through a technology of vision. She fits well with Annette Michelson's analysis of Hadalai, an exquisite automaton in Villiers de Lisle's Adams's novel On the Eve of the Future, first published in Paris in magazine form, 1880 through 81. Michelson argues that the beautiful mechanical woman is, as she puts it, the phantasmatical ground of the cinema itself. Furthermore, the mechanical Hadalai is a figure of transition, which will mutate into the beautiful woman typically featured in the magic shows of Georges Méliès, living but subject to the mechanical tricks of the cinema. It is not woman within cinematic iconography, but the female body, quote, in an ultimate phantasmatic mode of representation as cinema, end quote. Indeed, there is something about the way that Olympia replaces Clara in Nathaniel's hallucination that suggests a Millet trick of substitution, one of the key effects in his magic cinema. As he disregards the figure of Olympia, Freud overlooks the crucial place of the female body as fetish and site of displacement for castration anxiety, for which he himself would argue in 1927. Freud's lack of interest in Olympia, an automaton and apparently a spectacle of the technological uncanny, in quotes, has certain connections to his rejection of the cinema associated not only with newfangled spectacle, but also with the urban culture of the young modern woman. The fashionable flapper, very much the new, erased the maternal features, very much for Freud, the old, of the female body, cultivating a boyish flat chest and slim hips. At the same time, her high heels and posed stance evoked a mechanical movement that took femininity away from nature into culture. The flapper had an emblematic relationship to modernity and the robotic world of mechanization. Her heels clicked down the street, her fingers tapped on typewriters, and her syncopated high kicks in the chorus line prompted Sigmund Krausauer's well-known comment, quote, technology whose grace is seductive, grace that is genderless because it rests on the joy of precision, a representation of American virtues, a flirt by stopwatch, end quote. Just as the beautiful automaton has no inside, in quotes, apart from her mechanism, these bodies, artificially prepubescent, mechanized, and modern, are eviscerated. These bodies, Freud might imply, are saved from uncanniness because they repress the womb and deny the maternal and abject aspects of the woman's body that he sees as a true sight of the uncanny. Quote, it often happens that neurotic men declare that there is something uncanny about the female genital organs. This unheimlich place, however, is the entrance to the former heim of all human beings, the place where each one of us lived once upon a time, and in the beginning. End quote. The mother's body represents the truly ancient for the human psyche. Not only is it the first home itself, but its once-upon-a-time memory of security and totality must become abject for the child to become an independent and autonomous being. The automaton in the Sandman could indeed lead back through the process of disavowal to the ancient problem of the maternal body. An eviscerated, mechanized femininity masks and marks disavowal of both the site of castration anxiety and the womb, the first home. The element of uncertainty emanates not only from the blurred distinction between the inorganic and the organic, but also from the uncertain nature of femininity itself. Stephen Heath, in his article Cinema and Psychoanalysis, has pointed out that Freud's hostility to the cinema is expressed in terms of gender, going beyond his reasonable doubt about its ability to express the complexities of psychoanalytic theory. When refusing in 1925 to collaborate with Hans Sachs on the development of the film that would be G.W. Papp's Secrets of a Soul, Freud uses telling terms. He says, "There can be no avoiding the film any more than one can avoid the fashion for bobbed hair. I, however, will not let my hair be cut and will personally have nothing to do with this film." End quote. Heath goes on to point out that Freud's fears of feminization were realized in the image on the Secrets of a Soul publicity brochure. Quote, "The gender-anxious, emasculating image is more than appropriate. The cover of Sachs's pamphlet shows the oval of a woman's face. What does she want, and what does cinema want with psychoanalysis through her and with her for its figure?" End quote. For Freud, the cinema was as ephemeral as fashion, and furthermore, through various links between the two, feminine. Indeed, at the time, the cinema was widely understood to be catering to the tastes of the young modern woman. Even Krasauer, for instance, in 1927, titled a series of articles denouncing the politics, aesthetics, and ideologies of contemporary popular cinema, "Little Shop Girls Go to the Movies." From the perspective of the Freudian unconscious, the very modernity of the cinema rendered it uninteresting, celebrating, as it did, with the newest technology, the novelty, speed, and glamour of urban life and the robotic, androgynous body of the young modern woman. But these links between femininity, modernity, and the cinema suggest that Freud's resistance to the new might lead back through the new to the old. By the time that Freud associated the cinema with the fashionable and feminine, it had discarded its association with the cultures of the late 19th century. Growing up into the youthfulness of modernity, the cinema acquired its defining attribute, an objective alliance with fiction, stars, and glamour. Now it has aged. Now the cinema seems closer to Freud's uncanny of the old and familiar, and thus metaphorically to the archaic body of the mother. Fiction, stars, and glamour have undergone a sea change. Those young modern women who were so anathema to Freud on film are unchanged by time, and while they still move with the same mechanical exactitude, acting out the uncanniness of Jentsch's automata, they belong to a world that has been relegated to the distant past by time and in cinema to its history. To look back into the reality of that lost world by means of the cinema is to have the sensation of looking into a time machine. However cliched the concept, the presence of that reality, of the past preserved, becomes increasingly magical and uncanny. Furthermore, as electronic and digital technologies have overtaken the cinema, and as a new arrives, the old new becomes relegated to the old. Paradoxically and incidentally, the new technologies have contributed further to bringing the uncanny back to the cinema. The ease with which the moving image can now be halted exposes the cinema's mechanisms and the illusion of its movement, as though the beautiful automaton had become stuck in a particular pose. Film historians have pointed out, quite correctly, that the cinema and its prehistory are too deeply imbricated, ideologically and technologically, for an abrupt birth of the cinema to be conceptually valid. That birth of the cinema was in quotes. But from the perspective of the uncanny, the arrival of celluloid moving pictures constitutes a decisive moment. It was only then that the reality of photography fused with mechanical movement, hitherto restricted to animated pictures, to reproduce the illusion of life itself that is essential to the cinema. But the image of life was necessarily haunted by deception. In the cinema, organic movement is transformed into its inorganic replica, a series of static, inanimate images which, once projected, then become animated to blur the distinction between the oppositions. The homologies extend. On the one hand, the inanimate, inorganic, still dead. On the other, organic, animate, moving, alive. It is here with the blurring of these boundaries that the uncanny nature of the cinematic image returns most forcefully, and with it, the conceptual space of uncertainty. That is the difficulty of understanding time and the presence of death in life. We can certainly say with Freud that we have surmounted, in quotes, belief in the return of the dead, of animate forces in nature, and even belief in the afterlife. However, the presence of the past in the cinema is also the presence of the body resurrected, and these images can trigger, if only by association, questions that still seem imponderable: the nature of time, the fragility of human life, and the boundary between life and death. Shout out to David Lasley, who suggested this reading.